Welcome to the Food Matters Live podcast, where we showcase the innovations, the big ideas, and the visionaries in the food industry. We dig deep, we look to the future and the past, and we question everything that we think we know about food. I'm Stefan Gates. I'm a food science writer, TV presenter, and a gastronaut. Today, we're talking about nutrition and hormones. Hormones are immensely powerful biochemical messengers that control lots of our bodily functions, but also control our behavior. I guess oxytocin is probably the most fascinating of them all, with a crucial role in love, sex, trust, childbirth, breastfeeding. And you probably wouldn't even be here without estrogen, progesterone, and testosterone, the female and male sex hormones. They're all part of the vast endocrine system, controlling our bodies in countless ways. Things like appetite, metabolism, sleep, reproduction, body temperature, mood, you name it, there's a hormone controlling it. But this is a delicate system, and if hormone balance is out of whack, the effects can be huge. So how does our nutrition interact with this system? Is it possible to improve overall hormonal balance by tweaking what we eat? Can we target specific things like better sleep or a more regulated appetite without adversely affecting other aspects of the system? And is the food industry aware of its effect on our inner hormonal lives? To find out, I'm joined by clinical nutritionist Susie Sawyer, who has decades of experience in the natural healthcare arena and runs a nutrition clinic dealing with complex health conditions. Susie, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you. It's lovely to be here. Thank you for inviting me, Stefan.
Oh, it's fantastic to have you. So first of all, can we just sort of pick apart the basics? We've all heard about hormones, but for most of us, our understanding's pretty shallow. How do hormones work?
Well, it's fascinating. As with everything in the human body, it is incredibly complex. And a lot of that comes down to biochemistry. And actually, when I say to some of my clients, you know, we're just biochemistry, they look at me rather glumly, because for all the glamour on the outside and the pizzazz, actually what goes on inside is biochemistry, and it is incredibly complex and works within these pathways. So let's look at the basics, as you said. So there are around 50 hormones. As you said, the system is called the endocrine system. And essentially, the hormones are secreted from glands. So those glands are the pituitary gland, the thyroid, parathyroid, adrenal, pineal, but also other organs secrete hormones. So the heart, the ovaries, the testes, the small intestine. We're secreting them from various places, and then they are sent to the interstitial fluid and then into the blood. So you talked about the steroidal hormones, the estrogen, which of course we talk about a lot. So there are different types of hormones. So the steroidal hormones are fat soluble, and they are produced from cholesterol. And of course, cholesterol gets such a bad rap, doesn't it? But of course, it's absolutely essential for the production of hormones. So particularly the estrogen and progesterone. But some hormones also work, just to complicate things even more, they also work as neurotransmitters. So, for example, serotonin, which we call our happy hormone, we need it for mood and motivation, but actually it's a neurotransmitter as well. And so is nitric oxide, which is essential for the heart function. So the nervous system and the hormonal system work very closely together. And basically the secretion either comes from signals from the nervous system or chemical changes in the blood, and then other hormonal systems kick in. So we also have hormones, I said there are different types, we also have hormones produced from amino acids. And as we go through, and from a nutritional point of view, we'll talk a lot more about protein. And it's one of those things, protein is so, so important for so many reasons, but it is very important for producing some of these hormones as well. So for example, one of our protein hormones is thyroid stimulating hormone. And there's just one other type of hormone which we are learning more about, eicosanoids, and they're produced from fatty acids, so arachidonic acid. So different types of hormones, all with different functions, all interacting though, you know, with the body. We can never separate one part from another, can we? We have to look at it as a whole.
Yeah. Okay. So I get a sense that a lot of companies throw in words like oxytocin and estrogen into marketing material. And just, it's like a little sort of, you know, like a knowledge bomb, thinking that, and people go, oh, okay, so that's really important. But we have no real understanding of how it works. Now, so what we talk about a lot is these ideas of hormone balance or hormone imbalance. How does that work? Are there surprising ways in which hormones interact? Is there such a thing as hormonal balance and imbalance? Or is that something cooked up by people who want to sell us supplements?
It's not fallacy at all. There is an amazing... Everything in the body is about balance, actually. And so, therefore, in terms of the hormones, how they interact with each other, and one can't work without another. So, you know, there is an amazingly delicate balance between estrogen and progesterone, you know. And we don't fully understand how, you know, when women get PMS symptoms, for example, we don't fully understand it, but we understand there's an imbalance between the estrogen and progesterone. But also, you know, for example, like with estrogen, and there's not just one type of estrogen, there's several estrogens. So the estrogen is secreted from the ovaries, and we can't produce eggs unless we've also got follicle stimulating hormone working with it. So the two work very well together. But another good example of it, I think, is where we've got an antagonistic effect, effectively, with hormones. So, for example, insulin, which we'll talk a lot about, such an important hormone, and glucagon. And they're very much involved in blood sugar balance. There's the word balance again, that we have to kind of look at. So, you know, the other thing is, you know, I've talked about kind of pathways, and you know, we've talked about cholesterol being that starting point. So you start from cholesterol, that produces pregnenolone, that produces testosterone. But if you've got too much of the stress hormone, DHEA, then we can have what's called a pregnenolone steal, and therefore we're not producing enough progesterone. So then that affects hormone balance again. So women are going to get more anxiety. So you can see, I mean, it's a hugely complex system, but I think this word balance or imbalance actually is not a fallacy. You can see from then that all of it interacts very closely, doesn't it? You can't just take one in isolation. It's not a fallacy for sure.
And just as a slight aside to this, how do we know when we've got a hormonal imbalance? Is it symptom-based or is it blood tests? How do we find out?
I think essentially symptoms. I mean, people don't feel right, so they will then go to their doctor and a hormone test would be done or other tests. I mean, from a nutritional perspective, we do all sorts of tests. Sometimes they're done taken in the saliva, sometimes in the urine. But essentially, you know, people will go to their doctor and they will look at those hormone levels. But it's more really in terms of, because hormones, as you can see, there's so many glands, so many organs that secrete hormones, there are going to be so many different conditions. So even things like depression, you know, imbalances with menstrual cycles, you know, imbalances with blood sugar, all of these things, there's so many factors involved with it that, you know, you could have a whole myriad of symptoms, really, you know, and before we actually then say, well, which part of the body system is affected here? How is that happening? Why is that happening?
And also, I guess which bit of it is problematic? You know, puberty is a hormonal roller coaster. It's got to happen, otherwise you're not going to be able to reproduce. But then you get things like acne, depression, all these different things that are thrown at it.
Yeah, that's right. So different things. Yeah, exactly.
Okay, so now you mentioned diabetes and medical conditions like that. I mean, diabetes we think of as being very closely associated with nutrition. But are all hormones affected by nutrition?
Well, essentially, yes, because, you know, I talked about hormones being produced by protein. So that's the first starting point. So one example of that, an amino acid, phenylalanine, then is utilized to produce eventually dopamine. So there's a phenylalanine pathway. There's also the amino acid tryptophan, which is the serotonin pathway, which eventually goes to produce melatonin, which is our sleep hormone. But along the way, so, you know, think again about all these pathways, everything is this little biochemical or massive biochemical wheel spinning all the time, hundreds and thousands of them. But along the way, each of those pathways needs nutrition or nutrients to fire up those biochemical pathways. So the phenylalanine pathway, for example, needs magnesium, it needs manganese, it needs vitamin C, vitamin B6, to get it to where it needs to go to, and eventually to adrenaline. And we've got the same situation in the serotonin pathway, and that is the same for every single piece of biochemistry that we have within the body. Every single pathway needs an individual nutrient to fire that up. So, yeah, when I talk to people about food, of course, food is about enjoyment, it's about energy, it's essential for life. But within that are these nutrients, which are also absolutely essential for life, and particularly the vitamins and minerals, which all work as cofactors and produce enzymes in all of these pathways. And that's where it becomes really interesting, I think, the whole study of nutrition, of how those each of those individual nutrients affect those pathways, and a deficiency, you can see, therefore, a deficiency of one is going to affect one of those pathways. So you get gaps in the pathways. So that's, you know, one of the reasons really why nutrition is so important. People, I think, don't realise the importance of each individual nutrient. You know, some of these nutrients have 200 or 300 different functions within the body. And magnesium is a great example of that. You know, it's a really busy mineral. So it's interesting, isn't it? Fascinating, I think, of course.
And in terms of your clinic, when you give advice to people that's related to hormonal imbalance, is the nutritional advice general? Is it basically eat a good diet, which so much it seems to come back to all the time? Or is there a specificity? Do you often say, okay, for one particular condition or one particular problem, then you really are after one specific nutrient? You mentioned magnesium quite a bit. Or is it really basically, come on, guys, eat better and your hormones will be balanced better?
It's a lot more sophisticated than that. Of course, everybody's health can be improved by getting the basics right, having more fruits and vegetables, more vegetables really rather than fruit particularly, but having, you know, good, get back to as nature intended really, so everybody can benefit from that. Because I see such a myriad of problems in my clinic, you know, health conditions, mostly hormonal related, but there's lots of different reasons for that. And a lot of that can also go back to the gut health as well. You know, so much of that comes from the gut. You know, obviously there's so much more research in that. So it's looking at what's going on with that individual. We have to be much more specific about it. How much protein is somebody having in their diet? You know, we look at the individual nutrients as well, where they may be lacking in them. And that's actually where supplementation can come in as well. But also in terms of you have to be much more, you know, we talk a lot now about personalized nutrition. And that's where some of the more sophisticated tests come in my clinic and other nutritional clinics, because we can see more exactly what is going wrong. And then we can be much more targeted in terms of the nutrition that we suggest. And it also, you know, it's one of those situations as well, is what one diet doesn't suit all. You know, we're all individuals, individual biochemistry. What works for one isn't going to work for another. And that also is the case in things with like time-restricted eating. You know, we talk a lot now, you've obviously heard about intermittent fasting. It's very popular. There's lots of great research on it. Well, that will suit some people and they will have an amazing effect and they'll lose weight and their hormones will balance better. But for other people, it won't. You know, so it is very much about being specific, but looking really, you know, I take very detailed questionnaires before I start working with somebody. But it's also, it's like a pie, really. You know, the nutrition is hugely important, but also lifestyle factors as well. And, you know, the other big factor with all of this is sleep, which of course is affected by hormones, as we've said, if people are not producing enough melatonin or they're stressed or whatever. But sleep is a massive factor in the whole nutritional pie as well. And that's where I look at everything that's going on in somebody's life.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, I'm sure you've got a whole range of different conditions that, you see, but what are the most common conditions that people come to you? You mentioned sleep as being one at the heart of it. But what are the most common conditions, and what do you find your most frequent advice is? And I accept that it's hugely complex. There are loads of different ones, but there must be some recurring problems and recurring solutions.
I've done so much work with the menopause, so I do see a lot of ladies going through the menopause and all the issues that are associated with that, and female hormone imbalances. That's probably the main thing that I see. But also, as well, I see so many digestive problems. The two are generally connected. But so some people come to me with terrible hormone problems, but so many people come to me with awful digestive problems. Can't get out the door in the morning. Awful problems. We don't need to go into all of the exact detail, but it really is a massive factor for people. And again, a lot of that is so much of that is down to diet as well. And even, then we come and look at food allergies, potentially food intolerances, of why somebody is reacting like that to the food. But it isn't always the food that people are reacting to. Sometimes there are functional issues going on with the digestive system. Why has somebody been constipated for 20 years? It's looking at things like that. So it's probably those two issues are the most common that I see and cause and can be the most debilitating, to be honest. Certainly the digestive problems can be a real factor for people. And sometimes people are just not producing enough enzymes, they may be not producing enough bile from the gallbladder. There's lots and lots of different factors with it, but I can pinpoint generally where those issues are going, kind of where they're starting, and then, advise accordingly. So sometimes it will be giving somebody some additional digestive enzymes or changing the way they eat foods, for example. I always suggest to people that they shouldn't be having too many carbohydrates before they've had protein, because of the way that affects the blood sugar levels, and then that affects hormone response. So, again, it's looking at what is going on, because everybody's got different lifestyles, what people are able to do. But probably, it's hard to say really what's the most kind of common advice, because there's so many different factors. But I think where we have digestive issues, I will often look at elimination diets to start with, in terms of, sometimes, bread and gluten and wheat get a really bad rap, don't they? Obviously, everybody talks about it. And it isn't necessarily that the foods are wrong. It's just that we're perhaps eating too much. If you look at somebody's, I see some people's diets where, they're having cereal for breakfast, sandwich for lunch, pasta for dinner. And of course, that's a lot of wheat and gluten going in. And sometimes just taking the pressure off the digestive system, because gluten can be very sticky on the digestive system. So sometimes just taking the pressure off. So again, I think you can see it's really very, very individual in terms of how I work with people. But, nutrition can be so powerful. Because it's the cornerstone of our health, isn't it? Of course. So when we change things and get things working better, it's amazing how people, and that can happen very quickly, actually. Changes can happen very quickly.
Yeah, absolutely. And so there's nutritional advice. There's talking about maybe taking extra enzymes. Supplementation?
Yes, I've worked in the supplement industry for many years, and it's always a food first approach, always. But supplementation is incredibly helpful as well. So, for example, where we need digestive enzymes, we can take those in supplement form. And sometimes people just need more nutrition. So one of the things that we talk about a lot in nutrition are nutrient deficiencies. And we've seen, as I've explained earlier, how having deficiencies of certain nutrients and certain vitamins and minerals can have a massive effect on the biochemistry. So sometimes it's not possible to get everything that we need from the food. Obviously, I'll be looking at the foods where we increase the fibre, whatever that is. But often we need perhaps more magnesium if somebody can't sleep, for example. So more magnesium for that. And also with probiotics and prebiotics. So, of course, the research we have is so evolved now with the gut microbiome. But Although we can get those from foods, so probiotic foods being natural yogurt and fermented foods, and you know, prebiotics being lots of colourful fruits and vegetables, we can increase those, but sometimes we just need more and we need to get that in supplement form. And again, it can be incredibly effective when we add in, when we change the diet and nutrition, we look at the supplementation and we look at the whole kind of lifestyle. So that kind of puts the pie together, really. And also, another great example of that actually is women going through the menopause. So, you know, there is a lot of research now with, I know you were talking about that in the menopause podcast before, with phytoestrogens, particularly with hot flushes. I know we're still working on other research on it. But again, trying to increase the phytoestrogenic foods potentially in the diet, so that's pulses, beans, lignans. But sometimes we need to take that in supplement form, some isoflavones that can actually help with some of those menopausal symptoms as well. And you can't get enough in the diet, you then take it in supplement form.
Yeah, absolutely. And you mentioned magnesium, other minerals like that, zinc and things like that. What else sort of features heavily in sort of hormonal rebalancing?
Well, vitamin B6 is one that we look at a lot, because again, vitamin B6 is needed in the progesterone pathway, so that's needed to produce progesterone. But vitamin B6, magnesium and zinc work together. So the nutrients have their own functions within these pathways, but they also work very synergistically as well, as you would expect within the body. So yes, certainly magnesium, zinc, vitamin B6 comes up a lot, but vitamin D, of course, is one that we've heard so much more about. And again, we were talking about supplementation. That is one where we need to supplement for sure. We cannot get enough from the food. And we know from there's so much research now that's become so evolved since COVID, actually, some of the amazing research that's been done is fantastic, actually. We see how essential it is. But also, vitamin D3 is essential in hormone balance as well, because there are vitamin D3 receptors in the gut. They link in with the serotonin pathways. So again, you know, if people are feeling depressed in low mood, sometimes it's just a lack of vitamin D3 and they need to take that. So that comes up a lot. And people that have, you know, joint pain, muscle pain, often, or problems with the immune system, of course, that is can often be a lack of vitamin D3. You know, we know now from the research that we need a lot more than we ever thought we did. And that's why I will always recommend people supplement throughout the summer and the winter, actually, with vitamin D3. So that's a kind of recurring theme. Vitamin C, again, one of our key antioxidants, so essential for the immune system. We need it to produce white blood cells and so much more. So those are the sort of ones that we see a lot. But I guess any of our essential vitamins and minerals will appear at some point. And another one, of course, is folic acid, folate, which is essential now. We know, again, from the research that we need it to prevent neural tube defects in the unborn child. So again, lots more research on that. So every single one, I mean, I could, you know, if we went through every single vitamin or mineral, I could list all of their functions. And unfortunately, I think our listeners would fall asleep. But for me, I find it fascinating. But you just a snapshot there of what goes on. You know, I think that I hope that kind of is a good illustration, really, of what goes on.
Yeah, absolutely. And what about the source of the nutrient? You know, does it matter if you get your magnesium from dark chocolate or from spinach or from a supplement? You know, would you always attempt to suggest a food source rather than a supplement, or does it not really matter?
It depends on what somebody is eating in the diet. So, of course, as I said, firstly, food first approach, certainly. So as a good example of that, if somebody is, I believe that they're magnesium deficient, they're not sleeping, they've got anxiety problems, hormone imbalances, then I'll look at what they're eating. So, for example, if somebody's eating a highly processed diet, you know, the typical highly processed Western diet is low in magnesium. So green leafy vegetables, for example, spinach, is great for magnesium. So it doesn't matter from a food approach if we're looking to get nutrients in. The forms of those nutrients doesn't matter from a food approach, but I wouldn't be saying to somebody, okay, eat 10 bars of dark chocolate instead of a bag of spinach kind of thing. Of course, you know, it's a balance.
Damn.
Of where we get that from. And actually, I mean, I'm a great advocate of dark chocolate because it has amazing health benefits and it has got some magnesium in, thankfully. But the forms of the nutrients from the food don't really matter. But again, it depends on if I want somebody to increase their fiber intake, for example, then having some additional green leafy vegetables is going to help that as well. And what's great with nutrition is that what we find is you kind of work on one area and other areas get better as well, because that food isn't just going to help one part of the body or one bit of biochemistry. That is going to help for lots of different reasons. So I might recommend. And the other thing is cruciferous vegetables, for example, they help with hormone balance. So, you know, there's lots of compounds within cruciferous vegetables that help with that. So it doesn't really matter where we're getting them from in terms of the food. Obviously, foods are very complex, you know, there's 20,000 different compounds in foods. You know, it doesn't matter from that respect, but it really depends on what else I want that person to be eating. But then, of course, supplementation is a different point completely, because again, it does matter the forms that we take. So as an example, magnesium, the oxide forms of supplements are not very well absorbed. So magnesium oxide, zinc oxide are not very well absorbed. Calcium carbonate is another one that is not very well absorbed. I will often look at the different forms. So for example, with magnesium, there's different forms. So the magnesium taurate in supplement form is great for the heart. Magnesium glycinate is great if you can't sleep. Magnesium citrate is great if you've got constipation. So in that situation, we can be more specific about the forms of the nutrients that we take from a supplemental point of view.
Yeah. And on the less sort of sexy side of it, what about avoidance? You know, we're all blaming alcohol, sugar, salt, fat for various different things. Does this feature a lot in your advice?
It does. It does. And not because I'm boring. It's not actually one of the things, and I think is an important point. It's not about a life of denial. And I'm not perfect. I have a life. But what it is about, again, back to that word balance, it is so important to get that balance. And it really also depends on what's going on with somebody's health. So from alcohol, that is a very good one. Of course, alcohol puts pressure on the liver. The liver has lots of detoxification pathways and enzymes that use those pathways or trigger those pathways. But for example, with alcohol, there's a specific pathway that detoxifies alcohol from the body. But that pathway is the same pathway used by paracetamol. So if somebody has had a heavy night, then having paracetamol the next day is not such a good idea. So there's kind of one example of that. But the problem with alcohol, for example, is it does put more pressure on the liver. But the liver is one of probably the most overworked organ, because everything goes through the liver, and that includes sugar. So we've talked about blood sugar balance. So again, when we eat sugar, that is turned into glucose in the liver, and then it's sent around the body to do what it needs to do. So if we have lots and lots of sugar, we are challenging that a lot more. And then if you think the liver's got all these other things, all these other factors to detoxify, everything, all the pesticides, everything that life throws at us has to go through the liver, and it has its own specific pathway to detoxify. So if you then throw in a lot of alcohol into that, you are going to potentially cause problems. But some people have more capacity for it. Perhaps their enzyme production is better, their detoxification pathways are better, and some of that is coded for genetically, actually. So you've got that issue. The sugar issue is a big one. I mean, we can't ignore the sugar issue because, we were just talking about insulin. Insulin is actually a fat-storing hormone. But everything that we do, and now the research that we have, is about metabolic balance. And that comes down to the insulin response. So the more sugar we have, the more insulin we produce to reduce those blood sugar levels. We have to get that out of the blood. It's pushed around the body. But if you're constantly eating lots of sugar, you're constantly challenging that insulin response. But the problem with that is insulin is obviously an essential hormone, A, it's a fat-storming hormone, but B, it's incredibly destructive to the nerve endings. It is incredibly destructive to the capillaries. So this is why when people have, you know, type 2 diabetes, and obviously people, unfortunately, that have type 1 that they can't do anything about, but it can be very, very damaging. You know, people can eventually end up with kidney problems, you know, heart problems, eye problems. It's because of the insulin. Of course, it comes back to sugar. You know, so if people are constantly, you know, eating lots of sugar. So, yes, you know, there's very good reasons for it. But the other really important factor of it, or a very as important, is the gut microbiome, how that sugar and alcohol affects the gut microbiome. So we know absolutely everything. We call the gut actually the second brain, because everything stems from the gut. And and that's the gut microbiome. And of course, the research is, you know, so evolved now in terms of how important that all is. But sugar and alcohol destroy a lot of that and imbalance it. So again, you know, as I said, it's not about a life of denial, but there needs to be a balance for sure.
Absolutely. Okay. Now, I'm also interested in what we don't know. Are there areas where you think there are big gaps in our understanding? You know, as you said, it's a huge complex the system that interacts with lots of different parts of our physiology. Where would you like to see more research done? Where are the big gaps in our understanding?
Firstly, we need to be much more joined up in terms of medicine and nutrition, so that, you know, doctors are a lot more open to recommending nutritional intervention with situations. But in terms of the research, I mean, there's some amazing research going on. But again, in terms of we've had some amazing research over the last few years. There was a big study called the Finger Study, all about how we can prevent dementia and Alzheimer's. And a lot of that was looking at lifestyle factors, but also food. So they found that fish, nuts, fruits and vegetables had a very positive effect on helping to prevent some of those problems. So I think that we can do a lot more with that. But I think, you know, again, menopause, the situation with that, you know, there's not nearly enough research on understanding exactly what's going on when we think how debilitating that can be for women. So looking a bit more, a lot deeper into these phytoestrogenic foods, why, how and why, you know, how much do we actually need? You know, again, it's not an exact science at the moment. So I can say to somebody, you know, you need more beans and pulses and take a supplement. So, you know, the research sort of suggests that we probably need 100 milligrams, 150 milligrams of isoflavones in a day. But again, being a lot more specific about it would be very helpful. And also, I think taking some examples from some of our societies where we know there are very long-lived populations. I think one of the areas of study I find so fascinating is longevity. So why do some countries do so much better in terms of their longevity rates than others? So we know, for example, Sardinia have some of the longest living people, and a lot of that we know now is down to the Mediterranean diet, which I do advocate a lot. I think it's fantastic. Again, amazing research on that. But again, I think if there was more research generally on it, then there would be more of a joined up approach. I think what's frustrating from a nutritional perspective, particularly where we've got so many issues with obesity, you know, is why there's not more kind of from the medicinal perspective, they're actually putting right the nutritional problems. There's not really enough prevention going on. But perhaps if there was more research on that, there might be more of a joined up approach. But I think there's kind of big gaps, really. And I guess a lot of it is down to funding. You know, obviously, so much funding goes into pharmaceuticals and medicines, but not nearly enough is available, you know, from a nutritional point of view. So I think that it would be great, some of these areas that are lacking. But I think we've started, you know, we're getting there. As I said, the Finger Study and some of these other really large studies on dementia are great. And what's also interesting is now they are connecting up some of these issues with dementia and also with Parkinson's. They're connecting that up to the gut problems. which I think is great. So again, and that the gut comes back to nutrition. And I think when we've got more of that research, which absolutely, you know, is unequivocal in terms of the gut, what goes on in the gut is affecting so many of our really serious degenerative diseases, then maybe things, you know, will move on a lot more with it. Mm.
And with all of that in mind, my last question really is, you know, what can the food industry help in some way? Do you think that the food industry could offer more help in terms of sorting out hormone imbalances, or is it really down to individuals and specialists like yourself?
It's a difficult one because obviously I don't want to say too much against the food industry, of course.
Oh no, go for it. That's the arena we're in.
I think what's difficult for people, to be quite honest, is it's confusing. There's so much information out there, and I think part of the issues that we have is that it's confusing. And these are, my clients said, well, I've read this and it says this, and then I've read this and it says that. I really don't know what to do. And I think a lot of that conflict potentially comes from the food industry, and also the packaging, of course. You know, when somebody looks at something that says a breakfast biscuit, they think, oh, you know, automatically we think, oh, that's healthy, that's what I'm going to eat for my breakfast. So I think a lot of that is down to the food industry, but of course that's a difficult one because they're commercial organizations, so, and they want to sell products. So I think,
but could they make more money by helping people out with nutritional tools, by helping their you know, so you could choose foods that help your hormone imbalance if you have one?
Well, potentially they could, but I guess, to be honest with you, a lot of the foods that help those hormonal imbalances are not as tasty as the ones that the food industry promotes. So obviously there's a massive market in processed foods. Obviously we're seeing that now with the vegan and vegetarian situations. You know, we're swapping one set of problems for another set of problems in terms of what's in the food aisles with all the processed parts of that. So unfortunately, a lot of the situation in terms of how we can help those hormonal imbalances, going back to, I know it sounds really dull, but it going back to what nature intended. Those foods in their more natural state will deliver more nutrients. Some of those nutrients I was talking about, vitamin B6, magnesium, zinc, that will help those hormonal imbalances. And of course, that's not a very sexy way of promoting anything, is it really? This is the problem. How it can evolve, I'm not exactly sure. I know what needs to happen, but unfortunately, we've been pushed so far the other way in terms of how we think, you know, and it's not just us in the UK, but we have a lot of issues in terms of obesity. We're the third most obese nation now in Europe, with all of these things. But it's very hard then when people get a taste of high fat, high sugar, high salt, tasty foods, for them to eat foods that perhaps are not as tasty. And also there's a perception, and maybe the food industry can help with this, and obviously there's, you know, lots of delivery companies and all sorts of things that deliver those individual ingredients, but actually trying to encourage people more to cook from fresh, so use those ingredients and put something together from scratch, which doesn't need to take any longer than putting something in the oven, something in the microwave or whatever. You know, there's a perception within us that people think, oh, I'm just going to go and buy something ready-made because that's quicker. It doesn't always have to be. So I don't know. I know what, as I say, needs to happen, how it can happen.
That's the tricky bit.
Really, really tricky one. I personally think that what will happen, and this is rather slightly kind of concerning, but because our health is really not going in a good direction at the moment, we know that from research. We know from our national diet and nutrition surveys about nutrient deficiencies. So we have a lot of this data, but we also now are seeing the increase in obesity rates. It's almost like we have to get to a situation where our health really does become in crisis before something then shifts, you know, because everything in life is cyclical, isn't it? And maybe people will start to realize that actually people need to take control of their own health and their nutrition and their lifestyle to be able to do something. It is a difficult one because there's so many different facets to it, isn't it? But and I don't want to end on a negative note.
I was just thinking, I think you just ended on a positive note because that's what needs to happen. And the more we do of that, then the healthier we'll be.
Yeah.
Well, that was a huge amount of information. I think you really unpacked the combination between nutrition and hormones brilliantly. So Susie Sawyer, thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you, Stefan. It's been a pleasure.
Excellent. Well, I hope you enjoyed this episode. If you did, there are hundreds more at foodmatterslive.com. To make sure you never miss an episode, subscribe to the Food Matters Live podcast on your preferred platform. And if you feel inclined, why not leave us a review? Thank you so much for listening.